Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Can I please speak with Isabella Rossellini?
Speaking.
I love the fact that I'm hearing. What am I hearing in the background? Apart from
a
you,
dog barking.
A dog. I mean, how much better could that be?
Exactly. You have dog barking. Chickens. I don't know what sound do they make. I don't know how to say in English.
You would then know. You would know.
I forgot the name in English.
I forgot the name too. But what kind of a sound would they make?
They make a lot of different sounds. Actually, extraordinarily, when you live with them, I have about 120 chickens. I'm surprised by the variation of sound they make. Some very faint, very sound. You know, very not very loud, but I can get close to them, and so I hear them. They're talking all the time.
Can you actually tell which chicken is coming from the sound?
Well, sometimes there is a chicken actually has a very deep voice, and then there is one that screams. I always say like a silent, like not a, like a horror movie. You know, every time I get her to move because I want to get her eggs, she gets so furious. I've been thinking about doing a video. You know, I make videos about animals.
I know.
But I play them. And I thought, I might do one about the different personalities of my chickens, because I was unaware that chickens have personalities, but they do. And maybe I should play them to show what I mean by that.
And what do you mean by that? Before we see the video, give us a sense of what that might mean, Isabella.
Well, there is always the same one that screams like a horror film when I put my hand underneath her to find if she has an egg. Others don't say. They tense up, but they don't say anything. There is one that... So some chickens sometimes... I don't have a rooster, so they lay their eggs, but none of their eggs are fertilized. They don't need a rooster to lay the eggs. But sometimes they go broody, we say, and that is when hormonal chemicals kicks in them and makes them sit on the eggs for 21 days that will take to have an embryo inside develop. And some chickens, they go broody, and they sit, and they become like Sleeping Beauty. They sit there with eyes like drugged out. They don't move, and they just warm the eggs that they have in their imagination. And so when they go brooding, I try to get them out of their nest and walk around and eat. They don't eat, they don't drink. They just want to keep the eggs warm. And one of them, I was trying to always encourage her to stop being broody. And she's like, she's drunk. You know, when I get her out of the nest, I put her on the grass. She walks like completely dizzy, you know, slightly like drunk a little bit. And often she might take a bite or two and maybe a sip of water. And then, boom, she runs back to sit on the imaginary eggs that she has in her mind. So, I mean, this kind of thing I would like to do. Maybe I'll play them.
I think you probably will, and it will be for our pleasure. Isabella, what has a quarantine been like for you during these months?
And a different
way of asking the same question. What does a typical day look like for you on the farm during this quarantine? And you might want to tell our listeners what I mean when I say farm.
Yes. So I live on Long Island, about 60 miles from Manhattan. And it used to be my second home. I used to come here on weekends with my children. But about 13 years ago, it became my residence. And a piece of land about a mile from my home became available. A developer was going to develop 12 homes and got discouraged. And I bought it and created a conservation easement, worked with foundation, and in particular with the Peconic Land Trust, whose mission is to save land in Long Island and continue the tradition of farming. and started a farm. So there is a friend called Patty Gentry, who was a chef, who decided she wanted to be a farmer, and she does the most delicious vegetables. And I started, and she does heirlooms. You know, heirlooms are tomatoes that you don't really easily find at the supermarket. They're all seeds. You know, there might be varieties of tomatoes that don't have a very long shelf life or bruise transportation. So they didn't become very popular in the industrial farming. And that gave me the idea to do the same as Patty does with heritage breed. Heritage breed is the same as saying heirloom. There are breeds of animals, farm animals, that have become endangered because they fell out of favor. Chickens are not endangered. Of course, there's billions of chickens. But breeds are neglected. We only deal with really one or two breeds. To give you an example, it would be as if we decide we only have Labrador and Dachshund and all the other breeds of dog, forget about them. And so I cultivate, or I started a collection of all breeds of chickens. And I work with an organization called Livestock Conservancy, who lists them, the breeds, as critically endangered, or, you know, like the same classification as the wild animal. But again, it's not the species that is endangered, it's the breed. And I have 120 chickens now.
And this quarantine time, has it been in any way different for you from what passes for normal life?
Oh, that's right. You asked me that question.
I did.
But I
always say digression is the sunshine of narrative, so it's all good.
Well, you know, so I work as an actress, and this job is nomadic, so I always on the road. And of course, when I come home, I take care of my animals. I hired somebody to take care of them, and I curate the collection. But I've never been ever for four consecutive months at home. The longest I have been is 3 weeks. And maybe then I will just go for 3 or 4 days to Manhattan,
right,
or fly to Los Angeles for a week and come back, but never steadily for 4 months. So that gave me two things I did that I couldn't do before. I started a little herd of sheep because I wanted the lamb to be very tamed. And that means that you have to spend a lot of time with them, petting them. And I'm doing that in collaboration with the Parsons School of Design because I want the student to come and be able to feel the wool on the animal. So I have now 5 different breeds of sheep, but I'm busy all day long caressing them because they have to, and you can only do it when they're young. If they're old and shy, it's very difficult to approach them. I couldn't do that if I left every 2 weeks because I had a job or to go somewhere. So this one was a project that I've had. I worked a little bit more on my collection of chickens. One of the things that I always wanted to do, everybody in America seems to have done it in kindergarten, but I didn't do it, is to see how from an egg, you know, you put it in an incubator and you see how the chicks come out. And it was very moving. You know, you need 21 days. That's how long it takes the embryo to develop. And I could never do it because I wasn't sure to be here. And then you have to turn it because the eggs, you're a little bit like a chicken. The chicken doesn't only sit on the eggs, but turns it. And so even when he's in an incubator, I have to turn it 3 times a day to make sure that, you know, he's not always on the same side. And then they start coming out. And they start coming out, right? And you can hear them chirping inside the eggs.
Really?
That was very touching to me. And science believes that this chirping inside the eggs stimulates all the other eggs. And within 48 hours, they all hatch. Because otherwise you would have a baby chicken that it is a week and then another one. So the embryos start to develop as soon as the hen sits on them. And then the sounding that they make at the end of their incubation system is what stimulates them to come out.
So it's all at the same time. Like a sonata that becomes a symphony.
Oh, it's so nice. And I'm sure the mama hen probably responds and does some clucking sound to stimulate the babies. But I didn't know what sound to make. They came out anyway.
So it sounds like the quarantine has forced you to pay greater attention to the animals you cultivate.
Exactly. It did. And then I did two short films about Darwin, you know, the yes. Onassis Foundation, and you're involved with the Onassis Foundation.
I am indeed, very much so.
And you gave grants to artists to make films about the quarantine.
So tell us about that. It was a project called Enter, and you entered twice. Yes. And twice,
you entered, so to speak, twice
with Darwin. And what I found marvelous and I must say charming and disarming, quite frankly, is that there you are, Isabella Rossellini, reading Darwin, being honest about the fact that you're reading Darwin and falling asleep. Does this happen?
Because
to
it's
you?
A little bit boring. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, I needed the fear of the exam to be able to read the origin of species.
Yeah. So tell us about that project. It's so interesting.
So, you know, when I received a message from the Onassis Foundation, I was really happy because, you know, as an actor, all our job has been canceled. I was in a series, an HBO series based on Julia Child, and it was canceled. I do my monologues, and they have been canceled. There was a possible film to be shot in Italy, Arrivederci, canceled. So, you know, at the beginning, I didn't think it was going to be so long. I thought, well, maybe it's a couple of months. Now we know, especially theater, that it might be a year and a half. I'm only grateful that I'm an old lady, I receive my actor pension. I don't know how the others do it, you know, when they have small children and mortgage to pay. But in our industry has been hit very, very badly. So I was delighted to be able to write and act. And also I loved the limitation so that I had to do it without a crew. I asked a friend of mine, Paul Magid, to play Darwin. He was quarantining also here in the same village. I asked my son and his girlfriend, who just finished college, to do the camera work and the editing. And my son helped with, you know, holding lights and helped his girlfriend. And the four of us made a film. I created a beard, made it with the New York Times.
I must say, for those people who will go to Onassis Enter, pay attention not only to Isabella, but to the beard. To Darwin's Darwin's beard is a tombé des nues. It's incredible.
But, you know, the art of make-do, I always love make-do. And I kind of like the limitations, you know, that we had, but that we're still able to make something, you know. I think I learned that from my father. My father was a filmmaker. His name was Roberto Rossellini. And he worked after the war, and he created films that were known. The critics gave them a name for their style, neorealism. And my father always said, you know, I didn't make films saying, let me try a style. There was nothing in Italy after the war. And I felt this urge to tell what I had witnessed during the war. And that became neorealism. They are very, you know, they're films that look like documentaries. There is nothing that, you know, particularly sophisticated, because Italy was like Syria today. There was nothing. And I guess it taught me the art of make-do is the urge of saying something that is more important than how. And so given the limitation, but you still want to tell a story, you can. And that was, you know, my Darwin What is my the title of my film. It was a little exercise of that.
You know, I loved watching in preparation for our conversation today, I watched your very engrossing film about your father. My dad is 100 years old.
Yes, of course.
And you share with, I love the way in which, you know, you play Hitchcock, you play Charlie Chaplin, you play a number of different filmmakers, Fellini, with whom your father had rather a contentious relationship. You share with him a desire to convey how interesting and strange reality really is. And maybe you can say something about the way in which your father taught you certain tools for examining reality today.
Yes, well, you know, I made this film, my dad is 100 years old, with a Canadian filmmaker called Guy Madden. And Guy Madden makes, as an aesthetic to his film, they look like silent film, but they have sound, but they look all scratchy and old. And this is what my father's film looked like. you know, until 10 years ago, because film restoration, I mean, talking about the coronavirus is the triumph of film archives. Only in the 70s and 80s, film were in deposit, rotting away. That was unless there was a retrospective in a museum, you can see Hitchcock, you can see Eisenstein. But today, of course, now we can access all these films, especially now when there is no new production.
Right.
It's a, you know, it's a rerun. So it's a, it was a complete different reality. And my father's, who never really made commercial film, his films were rotting away in deposits. And when we would take a print and screen it, it was so ruined. And somehow Guy Maddin made film who used that aesthetic because it gives you this feeling of something ephemeral that is going to disappear any moment. And so when I work with Guy Maddin as an actress in a film called The Saddest Music in the World, I asked Guy to help me direct a film. I wanted to do a film on my father and the sense of ephemeral, you know, something that would vanish. Because sometimes we have the illusion that since my parents are famous, my mother was actress Ingrid Bergman, my dad was Roberto Rossellini, as I said, that maybe there is a law, you know, there is memory of them forever, but there isn't, because that work also dissipates. It might give you another decade or two, but still it just slows down the process of ending. And that's why I wanted to convey in that little film, my dad is 100 years old.
It's very moving. It's very moving. Your father doesn't appear, but in a way he is present through you holding him, holding his body in a certain way. It's really, I really invite...
My father is a big belly.
Yeah, he is.
My father was fat.
I know.
And I always loved that he was fat when he was a little girl because he was so soft to embrace. And also, you know, this big belly reminded me of a Buddha, or it could have been a planet floating in, you know, I photograph it, sometimes it's big belly. As a planet or rising, you know. Yes, but it was based on the fact that I always said that I always loved my father that had a big belly, and only growing up I heard that he was fat and he should do a diet, and I was shocked. That was the part I loved most about him.
Tell me, for this project you did with the Onassis Foundation, the Enter Project, you fell asleep, you say, reading Darwin. He put you into a slumber. He actually made you dream. But during this time of the quarantine, have you actually reread some of Darwin, or do you simply fall asleep?
Yes. Well, I did read another book, a book of Darwin that I wanted to reread, which was the one that he wrote about expression.
Yes.
So we often talk about Darwin as studies of bones and see that there was a continuity and the animal changes in the years. But he also thinks that the same is could be applied to expression. And it's a less popular book on expression of emotion of human and animals. It's
but
a less so popular book.
But so interesting also, I think so interesting for the profession you have of an actress.
Absolutely.
And so interesting,
it's all
also
about expression.
And Isabella, it's so interesting thinking about that book by Darwin and your early relationship with Richard Avedon and how he photographed you. I thought there was a real link between you're reading now Darwin on expression and the kind of the instructions Richard Avedon gave you when taking a photograph, telling you what to think.
Yes, I'll tell the story that I always tell about Avedon. I was posing, I worked as a model, and I was posing in front of Avedon's camera, and Avedon said, "Can you change your thoughts? I don't like what you're thinking." So I thought, wow, you know, can he read my mind? So I obediently changed the thought. And then I thought, how can he say? I didn't know that what I'm thinking. So I went back to the same thought and immediately said, no, I told you I don't like that thought. Change it. So he had something, a sensitivity, a talent probably, that he saw expression. I don't think he understood what I was, you know, what I was thinking, but he could recognize the expression that he gave me. because whatever thoughts crosses your brain, it does it translates physically.
Precisely.
And that's all about acting. And Darwin was asking a broader question: why is smile recognized as a gesture of friendliness around the world? But if I do an Italian gestures, it's only understood in Italy and not everywhere in the world. Why are certain expressions common to all men and certain others not? And incredibly enough, it was so observant, like Avedon, it was about the expression. Darwin, he was so observant about expression that he was an abolitionist. He writes in the book because he saw that Africans had same expressions as whites. We smiled, we frowned, so we had a common ancestor. That expression was older, and therefore we had the common ancestor. Isn't that amazing?
It is so amazing, and you know, so many ideas are going through my head at this one moment, and one of them is this moment of the quarantine where our faces are covered up out of necessity, and therefore, expression is so much harder to read.
Yes, it is. You know, it is. I mean, one of the big quests that I have is to do a show from home. I want to do a tour from my home and do my monologues. Mm. But again, I cannot really, I think it's a different tone that I use if I'm on stage and talking to an audience of 200-300 people. That I'm home alone talking to a camera. And that is the thing that prevented me from putting together a new show, because I still want to talk about Darwin and the animals and all that I studied while I was taking my master's degree on animal behavior and conservation. But I haven't found yet the right media. And I often think of my dad and say, you know, he would have said, no, look at the style, just decide what you want to say and say it. Yes, yeah. And just say it with whatever means you have. But, you know, in spite of the fact that we try to do films all by ourselves, I still need somebody to have the camera to press a button. And I'm handicapped by being old. I don't totally understand the computer. I always have problems. But I will get there. I will get there.
That's my goal. And maybe the first thing to do is not say old, but just older.
Okay.
You know, but... Isabella, if Darwin, as he does appear in the movies you've made for the Onassis Foundation, if he were really to come now and appear for real, what is the most burning question you would have for him now?
Well, I think I would tell him about genetics, because he called it the mysterious law of correlation. He understood that children look like parents and there was a correlation, but he was mysterious. He didn't know about genetics. He intuitively understood that there was a mechanism, and that was also the core of evolution, because the generation that had certain characteristics that were favored could have longer life, could mate more often, can have more offspring. And if this offspring got that trait from their parents, they would repeat it for generation after generation, improving their quality of survival, but he didn't know the mechanism. And I think that I will have a lot of questions for him. But first of all, I would say you're right. We know what it is, the mysterious law of correlation. I think he would faint.
Before asking him a question, you would instruct him. I love that.
I would say, I have news for you. You intuitively understood something that now we know it is.
Yeah, no, you would say, as you say in the movie about your father is 100 years old, you would say, you may be a genius, but let me tell you something. I want to bring you back to your early years, maybe even to your childhood, sort of thinking about this wonderful line of Graham Greene where he says, there's always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in. A book that mattered to you a lot, I think, when you were growing up, was a book by Conrad Lawrence, King Solomon's Ring. And has it resurfaced recently in your mind?
It has. I mean, especially King Solomon's Ring, because King Solomon's Ring is a book where Conrad Lawrence, who founded the science of etology of animal behavior, he won a Nobel Prize for it in 1973. That is a book, it's his biography. And he must have been an incredibly charming man. He lived near Vienna. He had all these animals, like a little bit like I do. Maybe I'm emulating him.
Perhaps.
And one thing that he did that I thought he was hilarious, he decided he had a baby and he had all these animals. And if you put the animal in the cage to protect the baby, the animal will not behave naturally because they would be captive, they would be suffering. So he put his baby in a cage to protect him from the animal, but he kept the animal free so he could analyze their behavior. And I thought that was so funny.
But
the baby will come out occasionally. Yeah. But occasionally when daddy was working, they'll put him in a cage, protected from the animal.
But in a way, Isabella, what I'm also trying to say is that book's made you follow a dream that now you're, in a sense, however strange it may sound, the quarantine affords you the possibility of fully living that dream.
Absolutely. When I read that book, it was really as a little lamp bulb went off my head. And I said, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to study. But at the time, I read it in the 70s, you know, probably around the time, you know, a few years after Conrad Lawrence won his Nobel Prize. It was very popular. My father gave me the book. There wasn't any animal behavioral studies that I could follow. And I thought about going to study agriculture because I always loved the country. But at the time, the farms were abandoned in Italy, as were in America, the smaller artisanal farm. Mm. It was the moment of great triumph of the big industry of food. And, you know, it was right after the war. And so I got discouraged. And that dream, this is what is so great about growing old. When you grow old, you do what you always wanted to do. You realize your dream that, you know, people said, are you stupid? Oh, you don't want to do that. No, you cannot make a living. But I don't have to make a living right now. I've made a living. I now do what I wanted to do. And I'm doing so. It's so interesting, my life. And the quarantine allowed me to be home for a longer period. I thought I would be a little homesick. No, I think I would be not a homesick, opposite. I thought I would be nostalgic of traveling.
You would be restless.
Yeah, because I travel so much.
Right.
You know, I thought my nature is nomadic.
But you're not missing it.
I'm not missing it at all. And I haven't moved since March 9.
So this
that
is,
was my last trip.
So this is like a discovery in a sense. You don't need to, you know, be traveling all the time. In closing, Isabella, very sadly, might I add, you describe yourself with two words. You say, I'm an environmental artist. What do you mean?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, I say it when people say, what do you do? What do you do? I say it just to satisfy because I find the words very boring. But I think a lot of artists are inspired by sex, of course, or love or relationship with people. I am interested in animals. You know, whenever I say I want to be a director or I want to write, always people say, oh, why don't you write about, you know, your husband or your boyfriend or something? And I say, no, it doesn't interest me. It's not my muse. I want to write about animals. I feel like I'm an environmental artist. My muse is the environment, is nature, is mostly animals, also plants, but mostly animals. But it is a boring word. And the other thing I love most in life is laughing. So
I know.
I use it scarcely.
Isabella, what a extreme pleasure to speak to you. We began.
Me too, Paul. Are you been doing well in your quarantine?
I'm doing well. I'm extremely busy and very focused with these quarantine tapes. Every single day we have a program. So it's
fantastic.
So you know, and it's very, very varied. And I can't wait for us to see each other again. I will never forget.
Me too.
When at the New York Public Library you presented me with some of the eggs from your farm. And in that spirit, as we began with the sound of chickens, will you leave us with one?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Isabella.
Thank you, Paul.
Take good care.
Thank you.
A bientôt. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.